Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. This week, we'll explore the traditional and folk art scene in Idaho, learn about a virtual book release event presented by Auntie's Bookstore in Spokane, and hear a musical tribute to a legendary Inland Northwest teacher, and get Nathan Weinbender's take on a pair of films set in the 1950s. A bit of nostalgia takes us in. Music by Antonín Dvořák from 2015 in the 20th anniversary season of the Mehtal Valley Chamber Music Festival. Sadly, but necessarily not happening in 2020. This is Northwest Arts Review. So, you have a graduate degree in folklore. Now what? For Stephen Hatcher, a wide-ranging, challenging, and most interesting job with the Idaho Arts Commission. Let's find out about it. I'm talking with Stephen Hatcher, who is the Folk and Traditional Arts Director of the Idaho Commission on the Arts. He's based in Boise, and he has a project that is ongoing down there that we'll find out about shortly. So, Stephen Hatcher, hello and welcome.
Thanks for reaching out and giving me a call way down here in a different time zone.
Right. Stephen, you are Folk and Traditional Arts Director. What is there about your background that makes you especially prepared for that task?
Yeah. Well, I am one of the few, one of the proud. I'm a card-carrying folklorist, which means that I have a graduate degree in folklore that I received from Utah State University. And I've spent the last 20 years or so working mostly in the public sector, whereas a lot of other folklorists work in the academic sector, teaching in universities and such. I've worked overseas for 10 years, actually teaching about through embassies, presenting on American culture. Here, I work for the State Arts Agency in the capacity of the Folk Arts Program, looking at the traditional arts, supporting the traditional arts through grant funding and public programming.
Is that aspect of the Idaho Commission on the Arts unique to the state, or are there a small group of states? I'm unaware of programs like this in other states, and probably that's just ignorance on my part.
Yeah, there are other folk arts programs. Most states represent the traditional arts at some level, either through a state agency or maybe a partnership with a state agency and a university. There are, say, the Western Folklife Center in Elko, Nevada, which is kind of a regional traditional arts center. They're the ones that put on the big National Cowboy Poetry Festival gathering in January. Yeah, I don't know if there's a state that doesn't support the traditional arts at some level, but not all states have a dedicated folk arts program through their arts commission.
So your job description then covers lots of aspects of what could be called traditional arts.
Yes, it's huge, and it's an impossible job.
Just give us a little sense of how broad and wide and tall your job is then.
Yeah, it's urban, it's rural, it's ethnic, it's native. We've had representation in all five tribes. I have a big project going on right now with Mexican music through small agricultural towns in southern Idaho. We work, you know, in the urban center. I work in the urban settings with ethnic groups. You know, a lot of them come to the state bringing their dance traditions. So there's a lot of traditional dance from the Chinese, the Basques, the Bosnians. In the rural settings, looking at the underserved populations, I work a lot with the cowboy arts. So a lot of saddle makers, rawhide braiders, you know, occupational traditions like that. It really does span the gamut, up and down, left and right.
Right. Now, you are currently engaged in a large-scale project connected with the folk and traditional arts, especially, well, specifically in southern Idaho.
Yeah, the five counties in far southeastern Idaho, way over by the Utah-Wyoming border. Mm-hmm. So this is a fieldwork survey just going into these tiny little communities, mostly agricultural down there, looking for these tradition bearers, as we call them, the people who carry on these traditions, whether it's saddle making or quilting or Mexican dance, Mexican music. Looking at foodways, there is a small group of Basque down there. What are they cooking? You know, is it very different at all from the Basque population, say, in Boise, or from that in Salt Lake or the Basque country? You know, what sort of things are they doing in that far corner of the state? You know, the purpose is to find these tradition bearers, find these practitioners of the traditional arts, mostly for my contact. So I can call them up and say, you know, hey, would you like to be part of this exhibit I'm putting together? We'd love to feature your quilts. Mm-hmm. Or I manage an annual apprenticeship program where we fund a master artist to teach an apprentice for a year's time and bring up their skill level in whatever, dance or saddle making or cooking or whatever. You're a master, whatever, chorizo maker. Would you like to teach a younger person in your community to maintain these traditions? That sort of thing. So for my purpose, I'm looking mostly for contacts. This is a mm-hmm. partnership with an organization that's based out of the Cache Valley in that part of Utah, the Bear River Heritage Area, that spans the two states and is based around the Bear River watershed and lake. And they are looking for similar things. And in addition to that, they're looking for historic architecture, heritage businesses, these kind of things to develop cultural tourism maps and things of that nature. This is kind of a partnership between the two of us, Idaho and Utah. Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to say then that a large part of what you do is you have to find the folks who do these various kinds of arts? Is part of your job description, official or unofficial, then, to do essentially preservation of these particular ways of doing things, or these particular approaches?
Very much so. Preservation and perpetuation. This particular project is mostly a survey, just kind of digging around, poking around, making contacts. Usually a survey is a little more extensive, where we go in and do formal interviews and record them and put them in a folklife archive, do a lot of photographing. Under the present conditions of the state and the world, it's a little more survey work, but mm-hmm. but very much so. It's finding out what's going on there, documenting it formally through interviews and other sort of media, either video or photography, putting that in an archive, building a collection. And then, you know, right, doing some sort of public aspect, whether it be, you know, a folk art exhibit of southeastern Idaho or, you know, trying to get these folks to participate in some of my programming, like the apprenticeship programming or things along those lines.
Right.
And it's the same thing with the Bear River Heritage Area in Utah. They have a small archive and they build these cultural tourism maps to where you can drive around, you know, those counties in Idaho and Utah and look at historic barns from 100 years ago that are still on properties and that people have allowed you to, you know, to check out this type of thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Stephen Hatcher, who's Folk and Traditional Arts Director of the Idaho Commission on the Arts. We're talking about a project of his in which there's essentially a survey of these practices going on in southeast Idaho. And right now you are engaged in a discovery phase, essentially, of, as you said, sort of filling out your contact list for the various traditional arts. Is there a hope that some of this could one day be shared on a more broad platform in terms of, well, museum exhibits and the like?
Oh, yeah, very, very much so. As we talked about earlier, that's, you know, one of the big picture reasons for doing this. One of my other major long range, long vision kind of project is going back through the 35, almost 40 years now of folklife material that has been collected by state folklorists since the beginning of the folk arts program at the Commission on the Arts, and organizing that, digitizing these old interviews on cassette and reel-to-reel tape, and looking at the slides and digitizing those and building sort of a more publicly accessible archive out of that. So that is in process now. We just did the first phase of this, which is taking a fieldwork collection that was put together by Rosalie Sorrells, Idaho's matriarch of folk music. Mm-hmm. She did a project for the Commission on the Arts in 1990, where she did just that, drove around the state and allowed people to record their folk songs or songs about Idaho. So we have all those reel-to-reel tapes and cassette tapes and photographs and all this stuff that went into this book called Way Out in Idaho that she helped produce. So we're building a website around that, and you know, it's the hope that project by project, those will all be digitized one day, you know, and put together in this kind of Idaho folklife archive, digital mm-hmm. archive.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking with Stephen Hatcher, Folk and Traditional Arts Director of the Idaho Commission on the Arts. Discover more about the arts in Idaho at the website arts.idaho.gov. We'll hear more from Stephen Hatcher in August about a project documenting the music of various Mexican-American ensembles in southeast Idaho. There are teachers, master teachers, and iconic teachers. Margie Mae Ott is a proud resident of that last distinguished group. Born Margaret Saunders 100 years ago in the tiny Palouse town of Mount Hope, Washington, Margie Mae eventually studied at Mills College and the Juilliard School, and from there went on to nourish generations of Northwest pianists, many of them now teachers who continue to pass on her knowledge and wisdom. Several of her students will honor her centenary on a special piano bench program next Tuesday morning on KPBX. One of them is a Montana musician, composer, and producer, Philip Auberg, who now plays for us his take on a familiar folk tune. Shenandoah, in Philip Auberg's arrangement. Next Tuesday at 11 on KPBX, we'll hear music and reminiscences from Margie May Ott's students. Join us on air, online, or via Facebook video.
It happened this year. I was asked to perform at a charity golf tournament in New Jersey. So I woke up for this charity golf event, and I realized recently that I'm not like a good adult yet. Like, I think if you're a good adult, you like plan your outfit according to what will occur when you leave the house. But I don't have that part of my brain. I'm just like, one outfit forever, you know?
That's Mike Birbiglia from a recent episode of This American Life. Birbiglia is a frequent contributor to the popular public radio show, as well as a stand-up comedian, filmmaker, and author. He's just published a new book with his wife, the poet J. Hope Stein, titled The New One, Painfully True Stories from a Reluctant Dad. And this Saturday, July 18th, Auntie's Bookstore in Spokane is hosting a virtual event featuring Birbiglia and Stein. Auntie's event coordinator, Claire Davey, explains how it all came together.
It all came about because of Instagram. So Mike put up a post and asked people to tag their favorite indie bookstores. And lots of our Auntie's customers tagged us. And then our children's manager, Andrea Swanson, just like sent him a DM and said, we would love to do a virtual event. And he's like, and he said, great, let's do it in 10 days.
Like many industries responding to the coronavirus crisis, the publishing world has moved book tours and other promotional events onto virtual platforms, which has forced independent bookstores like Auntie's to adapt.
Like learning how to do it has been fun. We've had some events that were really small, like our first three-minute mic, our Auntie's regular open mic. We had like five people, and it felt really intimate and nice and sort of like a return to normalcy. But then we've been able to do these big events with like 40 or even 90 people, and a lot of people who don't even live in Spokane. I don't know. I'm pretty excited about what virtual events can do for Auntie's and for Auntie's customers.
One of those things virtual events can do is allow big names like the Mike Birbiglia event to happen more easily.
You know, with a traditional tour, money and travel time and all of that are huge factors. But if you can remove that, like all of, you know, those logistics, then it really opens up like a whole new world.
At the virtual event, Birbiglia and his wife and co-author J. Hope Stein will read from the book, which Claire Davey says fans of Birbiglia's comedy and storytelling will find familiar.
So the book, it starts with them at a film festival. And he's supposed, somebody asks him to tell a story, and the theme is jealousy. And his wife says, well, you're jealous of Una, our baby, kind of as a joke. And that sort of launches into this story about how, you know, these two people, they got married, and they had both decided that they never wanted children. And he has seven really clear reasons for never of wanting children. And one of them is that he has a lot of medical conditions. He has a sleep disorder that has really transformed his life. He had cancer when he was 19. So he just like feels like he lost a lot of good friends to children. He talks about his brother Joe, who was the coolest person he knew. And then suddenly he's like looking at 14-minute long videos of babies eating ice cream and just feels like it's so boring. And then one day his wife sits down and says, I think I would like to have a baby. And I don't think it needs to change the way that we live our lives. And that's really important. So all through her pregnancy and all through the pregnancy ends up being really, really difficult. And it's like she does nearly die. You know, they're just saying he's working, he's doing comedy and she's writing poems. And it like quickly becomes pretty apparent that the baby is going to totally change their lives. And it's really neat. I mean, everybody knows that Mike Birbiglia is really funny and, you know, writes, has a lot of really like great self-deprecating humor. I mean, he talks about sympathy eating, like he gained like 40 pounds because his wife who loves salad suddenly starts eating pizza and donuts and Chinese food. And he's, you know, eating for six is what he says. So it's funny, but then it also ends up being this really tender portrait of a marriage that's just really changing and the lives that are really changing. And it's all, the really special thing about this book is that it's, so Jen is a poet, and all of these chapters are sort of intercut with these poems that she wrote or on themes of motherhood and about her marriage. And I mean, a lot of them are from the point of view of the mother being a little fish, which I thought was really sweet. But it's just, it's a really special book. And I think it's really kind of unflinching about, you know, the ways that lives change when, you know, a third person gets introduced into this little two-person bubble that was really stable and unchanging.
Comedian and writer Mike Birbiglia and his wife, poet J. Hope Stein, will be hosting a virtual event for their new book, The New One, Painfully True Stories from a Reluctant Dad, with Auntie's Bookstore this Saturday, July 18th at 7 p.m. Purchase of the book is required in order to access the Zoom event. You can find details at auntiesbooks.com. For Northwest Arts Review, I'm Chris Massini.
In spite of it all, new movies are finding their way to audiences. Two recent releases, the sci-fi mystery The Vast of Night and the experimental literary biopic Shirley, are both worth streaming in your own home theater. Nathan Weinbender says they'll give you a lot to think about.
There's something inherently unsettling about America in the 1950s, or at least the plasticine visions of 1950s America that have pervaded pop culture. Everyone from David Lynch to Tim Burton to Stephen King has looked beneath the manicured lawns and white picket fences of Eisenhower-era suburbs to find violence and hatred festering beneath. And I wanted to take a look at two recent films, both currently streaming, that similarly explore how mid-century ideals can be a facade for hidden horrors. The first is called The Vast of Night, now on Amazon Prime, which is one of those rare independent movies that truly feels like it was made by a band of outsiders. It's speculative sci-fi that's more concerned with listening than looking, and that's no doubt because listening is far less expensive than looking. The Vast of Night is the debut feature from Andrew Patterson, a commercial director from Oklahoma who financed the film himself and shot it in 4 weeks for less than $1 million. Patterson opens the film with a long conversation between precocious teenager Faye, played by Sierra McCormick, and local radio DJ Everett, played by Jake Horowitz, predicated on rapid-fire back-and-forth dialogue like something out of a 40s screwball comedy. This sets up the running theme of worlds established entirely through words, as Faye, covering for her mother at the town switchboard, starts getting calls reporting weird lights hovering in the sky. Then Everett hears from a listener who recognizes those lights because he helped cover up the existence of otherworldly objects while serving in World War II. And then there's the old woman living on the outskirts of town, who details how her young son was taken away by strange visitors so many years ago. The Vast of Night is a confined talkie movie, and during one of its chilling anecdotes, the screen even cuts to black and becomes, for a moment, like an old radio drama. This turns out to be an apt metaphor because it's a film about stories that have, for too long, fallen on deaf ears. Josephine Decker's Shirley, meanwhile, is just as concerned with Untold Tales, a film about repression that has been made with a jarring, feverish style. It's as if the movie itself, which is now streaming on Hulu, wants to break its characters from their domestic prisons. The always terrific Elizabeth Moss stars as the novelist Shirley Jackson, who, as the film begins, has resigned herself to drinking and chain-smoking all day and rarely leaving her Vermont home. Having become a cause célèbre after the publication of her short story The Lottery, Jackson is looking for material for a new novel, and she's becoming obsessed with the case of a woman who vanished from the nearby college campus, where her husband, English professor Stanley Hyman, teaches. Stanley, played by Michael Stuhlbarg, has invited his newest teaching assistant, Logan Lerman, and his wife Rose, Odessa Young, to stay with them for a few months, a change in routine that has Shirley unfairly directing all her ire at the 20-something Rose. The film regularly retreats into Shirley's addled psyche and anxieties, which are exacerbated not only by Stanley's flagrant adultery and moral superiority, but also by her writer's block. In Shirley's mind, that missing girl's face remains a blur, but Rose begins to fill that void and, in a way, becomes the character. That metamorphosis coincides with her own burgeoning friendship with Shirley, which goes from begrudging to warm and develops finally, possibly, into something more passionate. Like her last film, the art world deconstruction Madeline's Madeline, Decker plays fast and loose with permanence and perception so that reality and fantasy swirl together in discomforting ways. Shirley is inspired by the sadness of Jackson's actual life, but also by the gothic paranoia of her fiction. The world was cruel to Shirley Jackson then, it seems to be saying, but it hasn't gotten any nicer since. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Nathan Weinbender.
Nathan Weinbender is film and music editor for The Inlander and one of the film critics on Movies 101, heard Friday evenings at 6:30 on KPBX and 1 Saturday afternoons on KSFC. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Help today came from Chris Massini. Our thanks as well to Stephen Hatcher, Philip Auberg, and Nathan Weinbender. Taking us out is more of Antonin Dvorak's music from the 2015 Nattow Valley Chamber Music Festival. Next week, a regional candidates forum takes our place, but do join us in 2 weeks for another Northwest Arts Review.